Being a good parent isn't just about having a set of skills or knowing the right thing to do all the time. Ask any good parent you know. They can tell you their pro tips, but most are happy to admit that a lot of parenting feels like winging it. Who we are and how we continue to grow matters because our kids pick up most of what they learn from us by watching how we do things, not by listening to our instructions. So join me on this journey of remodeling our mindsets so that our actions speak to those watching. I'm Dr. Dina Shelton, and this is Remodel Parenting. Welcome back to Remodel Parenting, everybody. We are continuing our series in Lessons from Classic Research. When I first started this series, I was excited about it because these are research studies that were a big part of my education when I was studying psychology, and I thought they would be really fun to go back and dig into and unpack from this perspective. And I wasn't sure, I was hoping that everyone would enjoy them, but I've gotten some great feedback about these topics, and it's made me so happy and so excited to share more of these research studies with you as we continue through the summer. Today, I'm going to cover Milgram's obedience study, which is one of my favorites and one I focus some of my projects on when I was in school. Now, I'll give the disclaimer, I am at the beginning of all of these, that these are old studies. They are studies that were designed before we had a lot of our research ethics in place. Many of them we would never redo like they were done at this point, but they still have a lot that we can gain from them. So we do still look back at these, but discussing them is not condoning or expressing support for tactics that are used in any of these studies that may not be supported or ethical today. So Stanley Milgram was a psychologist at Yale in the 60s, and he wanted to study people's compliance with an authority figure when they were directed to do something that conflicted with their morals. Now, it was grounded in this idea and belief that people follow authority and tend to look for and fall under authority's guidance from a very young age, pretty naturally, but it was highly influenced by the aftermath and the effects of the Holocaust and World War II. At the time that Milgram began this study, Adolf Eichmann was on trial for war crimes and heinous actions that were committed during the Holocaust. And, you know, at that time in history, people looking back on what had gone on were wondering, how do people become so evil? How can people go to such extremes? And then when it's all over and the leader is gone, suddenly kind of come out of this fog and say, oh my gosh, I didn't really realize what I was doing. So there were a lot of questions about that, about the power of authority and obedience to authority in terms of people's responsibilities for their own actions. And so Milgram designed a study where he brought in participants, and each time he would bring in two participants and assign one as a teacher and one as a learner. They were told they were doing a study on memory and learning. But here is the interesting part. While two participants walked in, only one was a real participant and the other was an actor. And so the one participant thought that two participants were coming in. The other person was just a participant just like them. And then it was a random assignment to being the teacher or the learner. The way that it was going to work is they were looking at how shocks or voltage shocks on people affected memory and learning. So once they decided who was the learner and who was the teacher, now both slips said teacher, but the actor always said that they got learner. They said that the learner would take in the questions and would answer them. And every time they got one wrong, the teacher would administer a shock to them. So they walked the learner and this actor person into the other room and sat him in what looked like a chair that was hooked up to electrical voltage outlets and would kind of wrap him up into it and get him into there. And the teacher was given a little bit of a shock to feel what it would feel like. And then they were taken to another room. So the teacher, the actual participant, could hear what was going on, but they couldn't see the other person. So as the learner was completing the exercises, the guy in the other room in the chair, he got a lot wrong because that was the purpose of the study, right? And so each time he got one wrong, the teacher was to give an electric shock. And they had this machine in front of them with buttons and switches that ranged in shocks from 15 volts up to 450 volts in 15 volt increments. And so what they wanted to see is how far a regular person would go in shocking someone if an authority figure told them to do it, even if there were other indicators that maybe they shouldn't, like hurting someone or someone else being in pain. For example, on the machine, as it moved up in increments on the machine, there were indicators that it could be dangerous for people, including at the end, something like an, you know, X's at the end, kind of showing an extreme amount. And in addition to that, as the shocks got higher, now no shocks were actually given. Of course, the actor was just, you know, giving some feedback verbally, but he would start to yell or scream or cry out to say that he was in pain. And then at the very, towards the very end, he would say he had a heart condition. And then at a certain place, he would stop responding altogether. Now, as people were giving the shocks and they were getting concerned about the guy in the other room, they would look at the experiment, you know, the experimenter who was in the room asking the questions and facilitating the study, and he would tell them to continue. You need to continue. The study requires that you continue. You must continue. And when they put this study together to look and see what people would do, he hypothesized that, you know, some people would probably go a lot further than what they would if no one was telling them to. But when they got to that question of what percentage of people are going to shock all the way to the very end, all the way up to the highest amount of voltage, he and all of the other psychologists that he asked at that time gave the same estimation, that about 1%, 1.2% was about what they would guess. Well, the 1.2% is and was the general idea of the human population whose lack of empathy and lack of emotional depth or connection to others starts to move into the place that we would call psychopathy, or a psychopath, someone who does not have the ability to connect to other humans and their pain or their situations. And that, so they said, well, there's a reality that about 1% of the population is that, and they'll probably shock all the way up because they don't connect with people in that same way. So as they were shocking and the guy was crying out and they would protest, some of the teachers, the participants would protest and say, I don't want to do this, or this doesn't feel right, I think he's hurting. And the experimenter had a list of prompts that they would use based on what they said. So they would say things like, while it's painful, there's no permanent tissue damage, you must continue. And everyone was pretty shocked that in this study, 65% of people obeyed and shocked all the way to the highest level. And it was just confounding to everyone. Because while they expected that some people would do that, the high percentage that did was unreal. Now, in retrospect, and even then, there were some realizations of all of the things that contributed to that. You know, you could say, well, I mean, that's just a group of crazy people. And the truth is that's not accurate. They, you know, screened these participants and they wanted to make sure that they had healthy, generally average individuals to do this, and they did. But what they realized, and what we realize now, is that there are multiple influencers for why we might obey or do something that we're told to do. This study was performed at Yale, on campus, in the basement of one of the buildings where educational classes were. It was in a reputable environment. The experimenter was a psychologist and a professor at Yale, and he wore a lab coat. And we know that visuals like lab coats and professional demeanors of people help us to trust them more because they're signifiers of a level of expertise or authority that is to be followed. And for the people who came in, the selection seemed to be random. They could have just as easily ended up in the other chair, and they were told the shocks were painful but not dangerous. And they also discovered over multiple tests of this that, you know, if the experimenter was out of the room, people were more likely to stop. But if the experimenter was right there and was complying in the moment, especially with all of those other things in place, people were likely to comply. And so then that leaves us with, you know, for most people, when we hear this experiment for the first time, it's kind of a shocker of what in the world? And so often with these types of experiments, we would love to think that we would be in the outlier group, right? The lesser group that maybe did the things that we would imagine ourselves doing or that we would want to do. But the truth is, none of us really know what we would do if we were in a similar situation, or how likely we would be to comply with what we are told, because we would be pulling information from a wide variety of places, not just from what we're being told at that moment. like those people who are there and pulling from, this is Yale, right? So if, you know, Yale has a responsibility to do things a certain way and to do things well, so if this is happening here, it must be okay. But there's a lot to be learned from this and applied in real time in our lives now. And I say it's not just what can we learn from this for our kids, but what can we learn for ourselves as well. We are not always inclined to do the right things or to do the things that we would hope we would do in situations. And that's kind of a hard pill to swallow sometimes, right? Because we want to do the right things and we want to be the ones who make the right calls. But the truth is that when we're in the moment and in the middle of things, we don't see it from the outside perspective that we can see this now. We see compliance. We see following protocol. We see doing what we've been told to do. We see following the rules. But what we can take from this is that positions of authority and power are highly influential in the lives of those who follow them. And when I say follow them, I don't just mean that we would say, okay, this is a person who I have decided that I am just going to listen to everything they say. We don't have to be that overt. It's just that our attitudes and demeanors, or maybe even our social media, follows them, and we take in what they say and what they do on a regular basis, and it becomes part of our pattern of thinking as well. And before too long, we tend to navigate towards being like the people that we follow. Studies, you know, a long time ago, I don't know if you guys tell your kids this, but I do. You know, studies looked at how we are seen in light of our social relationships. And, you know, there are different studies who say different things, but a good estimation is you're really a lot like the 10 people that you spend the most time with. If you take the top 10 people and you put them in a blender, that's pretty much how people kind of see you, is as a mix or a blend of those, because we tend to take on and absorb the traits of those around us. Now, I'm not aware of any studies right now on this, but I'm going to tell you that who and what we follow on social media, that becomes our authority, or that we follow in the news, or that we follow any other way, becomes an authority in our lives that we are seeking to guide us and tell us how to think about things. We're rarely looking at content from others to tell us what to think. Maybe sometimes, but even more than telling us what to think, it's telling us how to think, how to process things. And we don't usually stop with those processes and maybe critically analyze those. And so we are just as likely as anyone to fall into the trap of obedience, even though we wouldn't really call it that typically, but to fall into this trap of obedience to someone who we haven't really vetted fully to see if our value systems are a full, you know, full match altogether. And then we may end up doing things that we would not normally do and that don't align with our value systems. Most of the people who were interviewed later and who were put on trial, there was so much about the Holocaust that they said, I don't know why I did that. I never would have done that. They didn't do the things that they did because they believed they were the right things to do, period, and in a general value system. It only fit in the small context that they were working in. It doesn't make it any less bad, right? But it does give us some understanding and maybe some layers peeled back. We also have to acknowledge how power influences our behaviors and our relationships. When we talk about power, we talk about positions of authority that are over us, whether we choose them or not. So our politicians and our leaders, the leaders in our school systems, the leaders in our churches and our community groups, and how the people who are in power in those areas do have influence, not just in our own lives, but in our communities. And as parents, we have to be aware of how influential the power that we have in our kids' lives are. You know, it may seem like they don't listen. And honestly, sometimes they just don't, right? Sometimes they are not listening to us and they're not paying attention to what we say, but they are guided by our actions and principles. And this goes back to setting norms of what's acceptable and okay in regular life. So for example, one of the things that I see regularly is that if a parent falls into a habit of being permissive of a child's, you know, poor treatment of other people because they're young, and they say, well, they're just young, they haven't learned yet, that oftentimes makes that behavior continue longer. Even if the child can't fully learn and fully understand what they're doing, the expectation that you're going to treat people well at all ages is important, and being permissive with it or just saying like, well, they're just young and excusing it, gives them this underlying norm that they don't have to take care of people around them like others have to take care of them. And so we have to be aware that our influence and power in the authority that we have over our kids is important. And then we also have the requirement really to understand who else has positions of power and authority in our kids' lives. Because that in particular is one of the things that puts kids at risk a lot of times, is that people gain areas of influence and power in our children's lives that we may not realize. And that can be, you know, teachers and coaches, other, you know, their friends' parents, older siblings and cousins of friends and things of that nature, sometimes even people at church. And if we're not as familiar with those people, we may not know what their lives and their values are like, and their power and authority could influence who our children are and how they make decisions as well. In addition to that, it's that power and authority that can put kids at risk for becoming victims of all types of abuse by adults if they are not aware of how negative power and negative authority, what that looks like in their lives and how to spot that. So as people, we have to recognize our tendency to comply when the right factors are in place, not just our minds, because our minds are only a small part of it. And we have to choose our sources of authority and the people that we listen to consistently. Even if we say we don't give them as much credit, we do have to really decide what we want to take in. And sometimes that takes asking others to speak into our lives about what we're trusting and how we're seeing things, and identifying people who are maybe doing life how we would like to, and asking them, hey, who do you listen to on these things? Who is your authority on this? Who do you listen to for medical information? Who do you listen to for these types of, bigger system issues? And gaining good sources from people we trust as well. And then when it comes down to practical on the ground, I wanted to give a few of these for obedience. Kids have to be taught a balance with obedience. And when I say that, I find that sometimes because of power play issues and power problems, I find sometimes that we can end up pendulum swinging too far to, well, I don't want to teach my kids to obey. I want to teach my kids to think. And I get that. I want you to hear me say I get that at a deep part of myself, because I really want my kids to be able to think too. But as someone who has studied humans for a very long time, that's really not possible for our kids. And asking our kids to think critically and make good decisions on their own without having the right types of authority in place that they're obeying is too much of a burden on their brains. Kids need to obey. They need to obey and learn how to identify and value the right types of authority and comply with that, because they don't have the capacity to make well-rounded decisions. In all honesty, none of us have all of that ability. We have to rely on other people and other sources. Kids need authority. Adults need authority, because we can't know all the things. And so we have to be able to choose well and to help guide our children to choosing well. The other place is about teaching our kids how to practice appropriately pushing back within our cultural standards and settings. When they feel like authority is pushing on them in the wrong way, what is the right way to push back? What are the right words to use, the right tone of voice, the right timing and way to do it? And coaching them through that so that they are prepared to push back when they feel that something's wrong. If you feel like something is off or wrong, here's how you say it. Our culture, when I say culture, I'm talking about how it is okay in your group, in your school. That's going to be really different across everything from geographical location to our socioeconomic status, race, backgrounds on rules and family systems. There's so many things that can affect what is normal and okay. And we have to tell our kids very specifically how to do that. So an example of that, my daughter is kind of coming into her own and trying to find out what she wants to do with athletics and with extracurriculars. And she was feeling a bit stressed out because she's pretty athletic. And of course, everyone wants her to play, right? And so she came home one day and she was very, very concerned because she was trying to figure out how to give an answer to some pressure she was feeling about playing a certain sport she doesn't want to play. And so we just had a good and it wasn't even a long conversation, it was a shorter conversation, but that ended with me giving her very specific language to say, where I told her, you don't have to defend and explain a no. A no is a solid answer. If you're not breaking a rule, then a no is an answer in and of itself. But your response can also be no, because that's not what I want to do, and I know what else I do want to do. And then you're free from that, and you don't have to give any more of an explanation from that. If you don't want to, you can rest in that. And that really just regulated her and helped her feel prepared for those where she's not being disrespectful. She's not, you know, trying to buck the system, but she's able to maintain her autonomy in those places as well. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and talk on obedience, and that you'll share it if it was helpful. Tune in to the next episode as we talk a little bit more about a similar concept of conformity. Have a great day. Thank you so much for listening to Remodel Parenting. If you know someone who could benefit from this episode, I hope you'll share it with them. And if you love what we're doing, like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have topics you'd like to hear about, email us at info@theremodelproject.com.